Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm very happy to be joined by a new guest today, our friend Brad Johnson. Brad is a senior reporter and managing editor for the news website The Texan, where he's covered Texas politics since 2019, right?
Yep.
Right. So, Brad, thanks for coming today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, it's not, as you discovered, it's not easy to get here.
Yeah.
It's even a little harder than normal right now.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm not being disloyal to my employer by saying that parking is always a nightmare here, but with the construction right around where we are, it's completely insane out there.
Yeah. It's even worse when your Uber driver takes about three wrong turns and you end up in Timbuktu. He was asking me what I was doing coming over here. And so I told him, doing a podcast. He's like, oh, what are you guys going to talk about? Like, the only thing anyone wants to talk about in this space right now, which is Texas politics. So,
there
the legislature.
Based on listening to the Texan podcast this week, I thought you were going to say property taxes.
No.
Okay. So that's a good segue. So, you know, I want to cover the terrain of what's been going on this week and focus on a few things. We don't have to cover everything and what you make of some of the things that happened this week, what you saw. And then talk a little bit about the media landscape in Texas and kind of where you're positioned in it, where the Texan is. Let's start with what at least I think is the biggest, at least most immediate legislative story in Texas in the last few days anyway, and that's the House Education Committee passing out the school voucher bill, the ESA bill, which, you know, interesting substantively and also some process, some interesting process things that happened with that too. So give us like your account of what happened and what's going on with that.
So the House Public Education Committee met in a formal meeting to pass out the committee substitute for SB2, which is the ESA voucher plan, and then also to vote out HB3, which is the school finance plan. The way the House leadership has operated with this is they call it the Texas two-step. Now it's been used and overused. You mentioned property taxes. Senator Paul Bettencourt used that last session.
Just there's a constantly. Lot of two-steps out there.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's like, can we come up with some new, you know, phrases for these things? There's got to be a lot more in the lexicon here to use. But so they were meeting to vote that out. They'll be on the floor. I'm here on April 15th. At least specifically for the ESA plan.
Right.
Who knows if they also put on HB3. But these are, you know, two of the biggest topics in the session right now, probably bigger than anything else, I'd say. You have the budget, of course. That's the one constitutional requirement. But these two things, especially given what happened in 23 and what happened in the primary last year, the biggest topics that we're going to talk about. So they met. They voted them out along party lines. There was, you know, a formal meeting. Usually those are just had to vote bills out. That's not a hearing where you have public testimony come in. And so there wasn't public testimony, but they did. They did debate back and forth. And the first like 30 minutes of the debate was over the dang live stream or lack thereof.
Right.
And that's kind of what you were, the process things you were talking about. In formal meetings, traditionally, they do not have live streams. Part of that is that a lot of formal meetings are held in a room that have no capability for live stream because they're just voting out bills. They're not hearing public testimony.
And it's not, and it's not required by the rules.
Correct.
Right.
But also
now, you know,
right. There's also nothing in the rules that says you can't. It's just kind of custom. Right. And from what I heard, the reason that there wasn't for this is because they didn't want to open the door and be required to have a live stream for every, you know, low level meeting. Now, this is a totally different animal, right? Like, there was 100 people in this hearing, even though there was no public testimony. So there was all this argument over the live stream, and it was, you know, admittedly a bad look for Chair Buckley in the House.
Especially because he'd moved the meeting, right?
Right.
He had changed the date of the meeting.
Yeah, he pushed it back, actually, to give members more times to read what are called the runs, basically, on the school finance plan, how it affects each of the members on the committee's school districts in their own district. Right. So he moved it back a couple days. It didn't temper any of the passions on this. I mean, this issue is just played and overplayed in terms of hyperbole, I'd say. I think you and I have talked about that before, but
we've both probably been on the receiving end of some of that hyperbole, I suspect.
But. Yes. That's not to say it's not important. It absolutely is. But the sky is not going to fall one way or the other on this stuff. So they met. They hashed it out. They eventually voted it out, both of them. And so now next stop, calendars, and then put them on the floor for a vote.
One of the things that seemed a little bit obscure to me, and I wasn't there for that. I wasn't one of the 100 people in the room, and I couldn't watch it. But, you know, where do things stand as you read it between what the Senate wants and what the House wants in the legislation that's now moving out of the committee?
You know, a lot of this fight is over how we prioritize this. Like, what's the tiered system? Both sections, I believe, have a tiered system, but they differ. And I think the House's version, listen, I'm not the ESA guy.
Yeah,
like, I don't know all the ins and outs of the policy here, but I do know the broad scope.
I don't know all the details. Yeah. It's a perfectly acceptable answer.
but the from my understanding, at least the initial version was, 85% of these were going to be reserved for people under 150% of the federal poverty line. Something like that. You know, they're drawing a distinction, right? So there's a lot of talk about this thing is universal. And it is nominally universal. But that doesn't mean that everyone is prioritized in this.
Theoretically, everybody does not have an equal, just weighted.
Right.
Right.
Which means, yes, weighted. Great way to put it. Which means, you know, you could have Elon Musk's child, if they live in Texas, technically qualify for an ESA. Does it mean they're going to get
it? Given the number of kids he has, he could actually clean up pretty good
on
this.
Yeah, right. I think I saw the number listed out was like $1.4 million or something. I don't know. Something like that. But it... practically speaking, like, that's not going to happen, particularly with the weighted system, if we see that pass. The Senate, I think, has a less weighted system in theirs. But, you know, at this point, we're just quibbling on where we draw the lines.
Right. I mean, the good thing about that tiered weighted system, whatever we're going to call it, is, you know, those are all dials that can be turned one direction or the other in the conference committee. And they added
just in conference committee, but in application.
Yeah, right.
You know, when the comptroller, whoever that is next, takes it over. Right,
right. Right. If those dials survive the process.
But the reason is that the reason they're stuck on this universal concept, and, you know, admittedly, it's a tough thing for Buckley to have to defend because it is such an easy talking point for the other side. Like, why are people, you know, making $1 million or more a year able to get this? But the reason is that you've had the governor and all of the proponents of this touting a universal plan on the campaign stump. And over the years, you know, we're committed to a universal plan. Well, that also sounds good messaging wise, which is why they stuck to it. Well, now they're having to defend it in order to pass this thing. You know,
how universal is universal?
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, both sides are wanting political wins here, which, of course, it's politics.
Yeah. I mean,
right.
Yeah. Right. And there's also, and can't remember, and maybe I don't know if you will either, but it also seems like the House put these $1 billion spending limit on this for the biennium that seems a little harder than what was coming out of the Senate, but I might be wrong about that.
No, I think it's the same in the first biennium.
Is it the same?
The thing is, once you get the next biennium,
that's
where it ramps up, and that's where we see, I think, frankly, the fiscal notes are pretty similar. Now, I think there is some difference. I think the House is... might be bigger. I can't remember. But, you know, that's when we see it jump from $1 billion, because that's all the legislature is allotting here, to, you know, projected make close to $6 billion in the 2027, 28 biennium, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And that's more of projection.
Numbers that have been roundly disputed to dismiss by the governor.
Well, and, you know,
example.
The other point that like Lieutenant Governor Patrick has made is that this all depends on how much money the legislature puts into it. So if the next legislature wants to increase it, you know, that will cause an increase to the program. If they want to decrease it, that will cause a decrease. So, you know, that's kind of the punch and counterpunch that we're
seeing. Yeah, the back and forth, right. So, you know, before we move on and, we go any deeper and get ourselves in trouble, what's your read of the state of play here? Because it's really interesting to me that you know, how the market predictions of this ebb and flow as we're going through the process. Because, I mean, I felt like at one point, and I think this is still right in my gut anyway, the chances of this not passing are much smaller than the chances of it passing at this point. But there is also a certain amount of reticence. People, because of the past, I think, people are a little reluctant in open court to just go, yeah, it's going to, you know, they're going to pass something.
Right.
But that still seems to be the case.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I see the votes there. When I was looking at the numbers just very roughly on the concept. Now, once you get in the details, that's where it gets more difficult, right?
And where people say it could theoretically break down. I mean, peel off a couple of votes on something.
The votes were there in 23 during the third special session for the first HB1. The votes were there.
Yeah.
But the governor didn't want it. And so you got to take that into consideration, too. He wanted, in his view, a better program. And so then they scrapped that, went to the next one, and that's the one that failed. But when I was doing my kind of whip count on a conceptual level, I've had like 80 to 82 votes. You had some members who voted against it last session come out and say that they're going to vote for it this time. Keith Bell, Ken King come to mind there. Ken King, though, still been pretty critical of this whole issue.
Yeah.
We'll see if he pulls the lever ultimately. But there's a lot because of how much how many seats chiefly Abbott flipped in 24 in the House. You know, the votes seem to be there. It's just, like I said, a question of what the final blueprint looks like. And, you know, maybe we get through conference and the Senate wins out in whatever it is that they're fighting over on these in these gritty details. And then the House is like, no, all of a sudden, I don't want to support this anymore.
Right. See, this is the dynamic, right? Because we're both kind of going, yeah, it's probably going to pass. But the more you play it out, you do see that there are contingencies in there that make me reluctant to, you know, to give it, you know, what is the probability here? You know, I don't want to go below 80, but everyone's, you know, we know how this place works, and 100, nothing's 100%.
Right. 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 You can't count your chickens before sign you die.
There you go. I'm gonna try.
I'm trying to make that a thing. I'm trying to make fetch happen here.
That's very folksy. You know, you can't count your chickens before sign you die. All right. So I'm going to give you some dealer. A lot of other stuff happened this week.
Yeah.
You know, it's been kind of a, you know, as I was going back and preparing for this and listened to most of the Texan podcast, tons of stuff that went on, some of it policy, some of it politics. I was going to say dealer's choice, but let's talk a little bit about the motion to vacate the chair and more broadly kind of what Brian Harrison did with his week.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. So, I mean, this was I did not see this coming. You know, by the way, he's been portraying himself in acting in the House.
And we should say this is State Rep Brian Harrison, who's been
Republican from Midlothian.
Republican from Midlothian, who's been, you know, the most persistent opponent slash disruptor of the current regime in the House, opposed Dustin Burroughs.
He's lobbing parliamentary inquiries constantly at the speaker from the back mic. So actually, I think it begins on Monday in the House Appropriations Committee hearing when they passed out their committee substitute for the state budget. And, you know, he gets up there and he prints out the entire budget, 1,000-plus pages, puts it on the dais, and then has a sign that says, "The budget nobody's read." Now, my one question is, because he's shouting, he's criticizing it about saying it's a liberal budget, it has DEI in it, all this stuff. Like, nobody's read it.
Well, he had time to read. Somebody read it.
Right.
Well, he read at it.
Right. Well, I mean,
as an old professor of mine used to say, I haven't read it personally.
Yes. And also, like, much of this is stuff they've been arguing about in committee for weeks now. So, like, I'm sure there were some changes that, you know, you didn't know about unless you read it, right? But broadly speaking, this is the same budget they've been debating, and almost the same budget that the Senate passed. So he does that. They pass out a committee. We get to the next day. I think it was the next day, Tuesday. And he goes up to the back mic, lobs a few parliamentary inquiries at the speaker. And then eventually he grows sick of the responses and says, "All right, I move to vacate the chair, remove the speaker from that position." Now, you know, that is a privilege motion. And typically that is automatically recognized, any privilege motion. You know, usually they're speeches. They get up and talk about why their pet issue is important, right? But here, Speaker Burroughs did not recognize him. And now the last time that happened on a motion to vacate was when Speaker Craddock did that in, I think, 07.
Yeah.
And he just refused to recognize, which, you know, is also up to the discretion of the speaker. Now, the one thing, the difference is on a normal parliamentary, and I know this is in the weeds, but this matters because this stuff affects how this stuff plays out.
Well,
right?
I think you can probably assume that for most of this audience, it's cool.
Okay, cool. So on a typical motion to challenge the ruling of the chair on a denied parliamentary or point of personal privilege, you need, I think, 10 signatures to join on in order to force recognition. But on a motion to vacate, you need 76, which itself is a de facto speakership vote, right? Because that's the number you need to win the speakership. Burroughs said, you know, you must submit that in a resolution. Now, this is where I think is really interesting because under the rules and under precedent, challenging the ruling of the chair on a motion to vacate is itself treated as something in writing. Now, I think the writing aspect comes when you submit the signatures to officially.
That's my understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
But under congressional precedent, which is kind of a second tier precedent in the House rules, it is a resolution. And so here you have the speaker, you know, moving up in the ladder, congressional precedent over House precedent. And that's pretty fascinating. And it, you know, it's most pointed in this example here, but that applies to all kinds of stuff. Are we running the House more like Congress parliamentary wise than we are like the House used to be run? And I said this on our podcast, but ultimately, like, they do what they want, right? The speaker generally does what they want with the rules.
That's been, I mean, I think
within reason.
It's funny when you said that in there, Bob, I was thinking, you know, that's been a point of dispute in the House for maybe forever.
Yeah.
But certainly for the last couple of decades and during the modern period, you know, we have these periodic, you know, crises that come down to that, which is how much discretion does the chair have, the speaker in this case, whoever's in the chair, but the speaker. And, you know, how do we understand that discretion and everybody's implicit understanding that the chair is in charge and that they interpret the rules the way they want to.
Yeah.
At what point does that bleed into, well, they can do whatever they want?
Right. I mean, it's a fine line, right?
Yeah, it's a little, you know, it's interesting. I mean, that's why being in the weeds is kind of interesting.
Well, I mean, I think it's
critical.
It's slowly at first and then all at once, right? Like, you know, you're stacking precedent on top of precedent and ultimately, you get a big move like this because they can point back to 1, 2, 3 things in the past to justify their decision in the moment. And every decision made in the House, the Senate's a different animal. There are no rules there, really.
Speaking of doing whatever you want.
Yeah.
Yes.
When you stack these up, you provide a basis from which a future person down the road can make a decision they want and justify it, right? I mean, that's ultimately what they're doing. They're trying to point to something in either the text of the rules or the precedent to justify what they want, the decision they want to make. That's how these things work.
Right. And so next time, if this stands, they won't have to go to congressional precedent because they'll have a House precedent.
Yep, because they have changed precedent. Yep.
Even though that was reliant on congressional precedent.
Yes. It's a rushing nesting doll of
daisy. Well, I was going to say daisy chaining precedents in some way, but I think that's, you know, either works. It's good. So what's the fallout from that? I mean, just since we're nerding out a little bit, if you go back to that 2007 precedent, that had a lot of long-term consequences.
Yeah.
Because I would argue that sequence of events that involved Craddock's unwillingness to recognize a motion to vacate, and I can't remember the exact sequence of events now, although I was here, you know, led to the, you know, I believe it was after that led to the replacement of the parliamentarians and ultimately to the challenge to Craddock that succeeded. You know, there were challenges that session that failed. But then in the interim and then going into 2009 was when Craddock was deposed. It wasn't that thing, but that was kind of, that catalyzed the opposition that was brewing, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, what is it? Newton's third law of reaction has an equal and opposite reaction. You know, that plays out in politics as well. You know, it's a might as well be a political law, right? Yeah. Not just physics. Overall, you know, Harrison's garnering himself quite a following on this. And like, it's real in terms of social media. But does that apply to legislating? And I can tell you for a fact, he's pissing off a lot of people.
Yeah.
And he has been for a while. But what's notable on that is it's not just House leadership that's mad at him and irritated and sick of dealing with him. It's members that are in his faction of the Republican caucus that are sick of it.
Well, if we go back, and you talked about this in your podcast, but if you go back to last week and what Brian Harrison was up to last week,
yeah,
he embarrassed a lot of people that would be natural allies of him
right.
when he made the quorum call and caught a bunch of people essentially yeah. logging in that weren't there, including several people that were allies of his
yeah.
or at least fellow travelers
and,
or were.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, you know, one member, I won't name him, but he's a conservative member of the House. He told me, you know, we're all questioning whether he's on Team Conservative or Team Harrison. And the insinuation was, we know which way that goes, right?
Yeah.
Or at least it's going right now. And, you know, what are Harrison's goals? You know, people are always talking about how he wants to get back to D.C. He first ran for Congress. His first run for office was running for that special election seat that Jake Elzey now holds.
Right.
When Congressman Ron Wright died. And so he finished, I think, like 5th, 6th, 7th around there, and then kind of turned that into this run for state house when Elzey, who was in the House, left his seat. So a special election, you know, tumbling ripple effect of special elections here, he ultimately took that seat. And so speculation is he wants to run for that. I think he does want to get to D.C. You know, he's very proud of the work he did. In the Trump administration, he talks about it all the time, right?
Right.
And so, you know, the question is that his goal? Is it, you know, now turning it into some higher office state in the state? I don't know, but he's definitely angling for something. Otherwise, he wouldn't be, you know, making this big spectacle. And, you know, he thinks he's right on all this. And I've had members come up to me and say, you know, he's got points to make about certain things, like how we do the budget. Maybe it's not the best way, most efficient way to do it. But he's undermining making that case by the antics. And, you know, you can watching from afar, you can think, oh, he's calling out corrupt House leadership, which is what the kind of the general sentiment that a lot of people have. But, you know, when you get into the nuts and bolts of legislating, it all relies on relationships. And when you have no relationships, you can't get anything done. So all you're left to do is go on TV and crap talk everybody, you
yeah.
know. And now he's kind of getting into a fight with Dan Patrick, which we'll see how that goes.
Well, I feel like there's two interesting kind of threads to what you were just talking about. One that I want to pick up is the media piece of this, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but the way that social media has changed legislative strategy and legislators' understanding of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Abby Livingston, who writes, I think, for Puck now, but was at the Tribune a few years ago, was their DC person.
Yeah.
You know, she was on a Puck podcast a few months ago now. And she kind of made the observation, again, many people have made this, but that one of the things that has changed Congress is that there are some members who see their primary goal as building a social media following
yep.
rather than legislating. And in the, you know, and I think, you know, it's without impugning Brian Harrison, I mean, we have the evidence on the table that seems to be a mean to a different end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's not like legislators and elected officials don't build brands. They always
right.
have and use media. But there's something that the social media piece has become such an end unto itself and so useful for moving into all these other roles and
yeah.
building an individual brand. I mean, I think, you know, the answer to your unnamed legislator is, of course it's for Brian Harrison, right?
Right?
I mean, that
right.
you know, and that doesn't mean, you know, I mean, you were quick to say, and I think he believes these things. Those things are not incompatible.
Yeah.
But it does create a bunch of free agents and injects a level of unpredictability into the process that either has nothing to do with legislating or is counter to it.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say on what Abby said, you know, what stuck in my mind when I heard that was, you know, I've heard the story of when Madison Cawthorn got to Congress, he didn't hire any legislative staff. He just hired comm staff.
Right.
And that
I
was
remember
it. Like,
that. I
that tells
about
you exactly
that.
What he's up to. You know, on Harrison, you know, the fact that he knows what he's going to say when he goes into a hearing. He has it all planned out, and then his staffer, because it has to be, because he's still on the dais, tweets out, clips up, you know, the clip of him saying whatever he's saying, and puts it out there. And so it's very prepared, very planned, and right. intentional, because yeah. that's the goal here. It's not yeah. to pass bills; it's to make a platform and you know, make the points that he says he wants to make, right? And you know, there's parts of this where he's been quite effective in causing reactions in places, specifically, you know, A&M, various other, you know, agencies where he's tweeted something out about whether it's DEI or something in there. Yeah, right. Yeah. And it causes a reaction. And, you know, he can say, I've been very effective on that. And I think that's true. Yeah.
The other thing that struck me in what you were saying a couple minutes ago that I think is worth just picking at a little bit, which is, you know, the idea that there are points about the process that maybe, you know, like maybe we could do the budget better, or, you know, looking at the broader sort of self-identified reform movement in the House, basically, most of whom oppose Burroughs, and the idea that the House should be more, you know, could be more active and could, you know, like this thing going on right now in terms of the back and forth and the old reliable complaint of the Senate and Lieutenant Governor, the House moves too slow.
Yeah.
And we're doing all our stuff and you're doing nothing and you don't even have committee chairs yet. But something has been interestingly lost to me in all that, which feels to me to be, ought to be part of the conversation, and it appeals to the budget. I mean, yeah, the budget process is pretty inefficient, but you know, there's a reason that document is that big.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a big damn thing.
It's a $336 billion budget. Right.
It's a big yeah. damn state with a lot going on. And, you know, and there is, I mean, there's an answer to, yeah, we haven't read it. That's why we have, you know, an appropriations committee process that breaks it into pieces and breaks mm-hmm. it into sub pieces, because there is at least an attempt at efficiency there within the constraints of how the legislature works. And the other attendant piece to that about this, you know, why is the House so slow? Why aren't they doing more? Well, you know why? Because that's the way the chamber is designed. It's not designed to pass things. It's designed yep. to make it hard to pass things.
I mean, that's foundational principle of our entire system, whether it's federal or,
right.
or state.
And, and even right? more so in Texas.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Where they're only, you know, there's a reason they're only there there was a rationale anyway right. for them only being there every other year. So I'm fine. You know, it's an interesting kind of historical development.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly to see, you know, broadly speaking, conservatives sort of fueling this reform argument about, in a sense, making the House more able to do more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's hypocritical. I mean, I'm definitely not saying that. But it's an interesting development in terms of the underlying theory of governance
yes.
that is now being articulated by conservatives.
Yeah. Well, I mean, go back 10 years and the broad philosophical point made by Republicans is, I'd rather the legislature not pass stuff because that's fewer bad things that they pass, right?
Right.
And now it's not that. Now, and I think it goes back to the general philosophical change in the Republican Party. You know, that they're more comfortable with power than they used to be.
Yeah.
At least 10, 15 years ago, right? It's just a change. It's more populist, right? Trump has a lot to do with that. But I think this was happening before Trump.
They have more proactive constituencies that want to use
right.
government to do things.
And, you know, their argument would be, and I think there's something to this, you saw a lot of power wielded by the political left in yeah. many different ways. And those who are opposed to that were sick of it. And, you know, they saw
yeah.
all this stuff happen, chief among them, COVID, you know, the shutdowns. The political right hated the shutdowns. And, you know, there's something to be said about closing an entire economy for a virus that, you know, was not good. Don't get me wrong, but it was not the Spanish flu. Right.
Yeah.
So that's their argument. And so I think they're trying to fight fire with fire. And that's generally the philosophical change.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I mean, this is, we should come back and we'll do a conversation just about this.
Okay.
But I mean, I think if you look back, it's also an even bigger arc in which COVID, you know, the COVID response, I think, was important in all the ways you're talking about in catalyzing this. But it was also piggybacking on, you know, the post-Civil Rights era Constitution.
Yeah.
That is a much more active, you know, and in a direction that a lot of conservatives didn't like, right? Yeah. And again, one needs to be more careful about how you phrase those things, and not to be misunderstood. But I think all of that is kind of in play here, and it's making it sort of a fascinating moment in terms of how the people that are running the system think about governance.
Well, I was listening to Scott Braddock's podcast this morning, and Jeremy Wallace on it talked about Greg Abbott going here to UT to talk to the Federalist Society. And that ties into what you were talking about, because until the Federalist Society really was created in, what, the 50s, the entire viewpoint of judicial power was activist judges, like as it's described today. There was no originalist thought, at least nothing that had any, you know, meat behind it. But now there is a very formal and quite powerful movement on the conservative side to have these, you know, dispassionate judges who, you know, don't assert themselves except only when something is unconstitutional, right? The legislature is the supreme branch. But actually, now we're seeing it go back the other way, right? Because now more activist conservatives are friendlier to more activist judges, but for their own ends. And so it's kind of this, back to Newton's third law, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. It just takes some time to play out.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's there's an interesting conversation to be had about the flexibility of ideologies and political philosophies, and trying to get down to what actually drives the theory of government. Because I think in a lot of ways there's a desire to present those theories of governance in the terms we're talking about as what's fundamental. And it turns out, I mean, I think what we're finding is like something else is fundamental.
Yeah.
And your theory of governance is much more flexible.
I think it's winning and losing.
That's a big part of it.
When a political party and a broader ideological movement thinks they're on the losing end constantly, they have to adjust. And so they adjust their tactics and thus ultimately their beliefs on things in order to get back in the winning seat.
Yeah. And I think that what's attendant to that, though, that's harder to is what the, you know, what the coalitional politics are. I mean, in a particular political system, what are the coalitional politics looking like? And, you know, who in that coalition is benefiting from advocating for against certain theories of governance, and when, where, and how you should use state power.
Right.
You know, I think. All right. Pick something else. We run out of time. Pick something else in the last week you thought was interesting, important, that you or your colleagues covered. And I know you went to the Lieutenant Governor Patrick's, you covered his press conference. Yeah. So I kind of want to hear about that too.
Okay. I'll just talk about that.
Okay.
You know,
it seemed like it was pretty interesting.
It was. He basically gave a state of the session from his point of view, and it was a lot of rah-rah. Senate's doing great. And, you know, they're passing a lot of stuff. Back to why the Senate is moves at a much faster pace. They have a supermajority. They can suspend the rules. All the Republicans generally stay in line with the Lieutenant Governor. And not all the time, but enough to get the things they want across the line.
And the Lieutenant Governor really has optimized that office.
Oh, yeah.
To put it as, you know, neutrally as possible.
I mean, I think it's fair to say the most formative Texas politician in the last 30 years, maybe longer. You know, he's definitely up there. But he got up there, gave his speech. He said, you know, I'm optimistic about Speaker Burroughs. He's told me all the right things, but now he's got to deliver. What exactly that means.
Yeah. The message is, you know, I sort of trust, but am ready to verify.
Yeah. All right. Ronald Reagan. Yeah. I thought Ronald Reagan was out of fashion these days in Republican politics. So he goes on, he talks about that. I asked him a question about Harrison making the motion to vacate. He dodged that, didn't really want to address it. But then we got to the criticism from Harrison and those that side with him ideologically, that the budget's bloated and, quote, liberal, that giving Hollywood actors and productions $500 million in incentives. He was pretty forceful in responding to that. Like,
yes.
You know, it's a conservative budget. And this is, you know, he said about the Hollywood thing, people who disagree with that, basically they don't agree with any action between partnership between the state and the private sector. And I think that's true to some degree. It's also, you know, add the Hollywood aspect of this, and there's the political undertones, right? But they're not undertones, they're overtones.
No, I don't know if you were at that. I watched a bit of that hearing. I mean, you know, there was a long passage in that hearing that was about, you know, whether we would be supporting movies and product that included quote unquote vulgarity.
Right, right. Yeah. And Donna Campbell was, you know, she said a lot about, you know, we shouldn't be, if it's going to have, you know, sex people scenes in it or
potty people with potty mouths.
Right. Right. We shouldn't be subsidizing it. And, you know, that's a fair point to make. She's going to make it and we'll see where the chips fall. But, the Patrick presser was very interesting. It was a low media turnout because most of them were over at the House Pub Ed hearing.
Right.
My main takeaway from that is this is a classic Patrick, poking the house with the stick. Let's go. You know, the meme, mm-hmm. like, come on, do something, get moving. And there are a lot of reasons for why the house is slower. First of all, a new speaker, he had to get his sea legs under him, as Patrick has said, hired his new staff, got to get all that set. And then the committee assignments, you got to, you know, 150 members, you got to negotiate that and handle that like a ticking time bomb because it can be.
Yeah.
You kind of got to give the House a couple weeks of grace just from a logistical perspective. Now, as Patrick said, if in 2 weeks we're still having the same conversation, that's when the alarm bells are going to come off.
Right.
So,
you know, this is speculative, and maybe you have some firsthand knowledge of this, but whatever, you know, other people's or, you know, the various critiques, I do find it interesting that Patrick is so forcefully in favor of the film subsidies. It's not the kind of issue that you would think he would, you know, you'll get the other things he's seizing on right now, THC thing, the lottery, the bank shot on gambling on that. That all seems like pretty predictable Dan Patrick stuff. The film subsidies is kind of funky to me.
Yeah, I mean, I view much of what Patrick is going to the mat on here as he's trying to establish his legacy. He's, you know, he's much closer to the end of his career than the beginning. Now, for all intents and purposes, it sounds like he's in for re-election, and I don't doubt that. But he views this as
he's got more behind him than in front of him,
right?
In terms of public service,
and he views this as something cool that he can point to if it does lead to, a revival of movie production in the state. He can point to Landman or any of the Taylor Sheridan things and say, I made all that happen after the fact. And, politicians, of course, love that.
I was going to say the Taylor Sheridan factor here, I think, just looms large for anybody that's watched those shows.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know.
And the fact that he has...
This is not a Robert Rodriguez movie.
Right, right. The fact that he has Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey basically begging for something here, like two of the most well-known actors
with him
in the
shot the whole time.
Right,
in the committee hearing.
That's got to feel good. I mean, that's kind of power that you can't buy, unless, I guess, it's $500 million movie incentives. But it's not Patrick's money.
Right. Well, the other, completely trivial aside, but those little tidbits... You know, the committee also kind of had these movie stars there and kind of kept them on ice. They kind of iced them for a while. I mean, McConaughey and Harrelson sat there for an hour or so while they talked to the film commission folks and asked them a lot of questions and everybody, so there's all these kind of casual shots. It's like, George Clooney at the end of Michael Clayton, right? Yeah. With, the very various faces of Matthew McConaughey as he's sitting there listening to the film commission people talk, wondering like, When do I get to go? Yeah.
Well, congrats. It's about time you had a firsthand lesson in how the government works in civics, right? Yeah. I mean, far too many people don't have any idea how this civic stuff works. And so congratulations.
And once he testified, he was pretty good.
I mean, he's a compelling guy. Absolutely.
All right. So let's talk for a couple minutes just about media and the role of the Texan and what you make now that you've been here a while. So you came to Texas, joined the Texan in 2019. Yep. Were you there at the founding or was it just shortly thereafter?
Yeah. So after Connie Burton, former state senator, lost in 18, they, from what I understand, the next day we're like, all right, we're going to do this. She and her husband, Phil. And, they're very active people. They like to do stuff. She does not want to just sit at home and bake cupcakes. That is not Connie Burton. She wants to...
I just want to say for the record, I would have never suggested that that was the case.
Yeah, right, right.
Just...
anyone that knows no editing the Senate, here. Of course.
I did not raise that.
Yeah, no, that was totally out of my own head. And if she has a problem with it, she'll take it out. She'll probably fire me after this anyway. But so they started that. I was in Ohio working something totally different. I was in consulting, never went to J school. I had no idea I was ever going to do this. My only foray into journalism was I started a campus publication. That was it. And so I got laid off after the midterm and I started applying and I fell into this. And so it kind of dovetailed, you know, my career change and the start of the Texan dovetailed together. And we launched in 6 years ago and later this month.
Yeah. So say April, right?
Middle of session in 19.
So, you know, without oversimplifying and, you know, I trust you to correct me if this is the wrong read, but you know, the formation of the Texan was inherently a critique of the existing media and political environment, you know, political information market in the state. The heart of the critique being that I think the media was slanted to the left and that, you know, to paraphrase the tagline on almost all of the stories, almost kind of tongue-in-cheek almost in a way, that the other outlets were beholden to special interests. And this was, I think, part of her critique of the Texas Tribune. I don't think it's a big secret to say that.
No, she's pretty right. Clear about her.
Yeah, right. So
I mean, and you know, it's fair to say that it was specifically a response to the Texas Tribune trying to provide an alternative to that.
Right.
That's absolutely fair.
Now you're 6 years into working in this quarter of the environment, having come even more of a blank slate than I would have imagined in terms of not really coming from
all I knew
a J school or right. You know, any of that.
And in Texas politics wise, all I knew was that Governor Abbott was the governor. That was it.
Yeah, pretty good. well, good start. You know, so let's start, you know, with your kind of individual sort of how you sort of approach the job from working for the Texan, because you're doing, and I want to, you know, say this, and you, I've said this to you off camera. So, you know, I mean, you're killing it. I mean, you're doing a really good job. Thank and I've, you know, been covering this a while, you know, so hats off. But I am wondering, and I don't detect this in most of the stuff you write as I think about it, but are your priorities for coverage or how you write the stories, how are they framed by you, your home being the Texan? How do you sort of, you know, execute that?
Yeah. I mean, we're pretty clear that we are a right of center publication, but the goal is to not act like it, you know, to just cover things as down the middle facts, fact heavy. And you know, we do analysis now, but still, like, you know, we're not doing opinion and we're not trying to slip opinion in. You know, that's when things, and I view this the same way as well. It's when things kind of get off the rails and that's when the bias becomes overt. You know, the Texan hires people that are right of center ideologically and within our newsroom, it's all different stripes of viewpoints. Right. But the way Connie viewed it was, this is an alternative to the legacy, as she says, legacy media that is very heavy on the left. Right. And part of that's just natural. More people that are left of center ideologically want to be reporters. Right. There's not a huge group of conservative journalists to go after.
Right.
And, you know, something I've seen is, and also I'll add that the founding of the Texan for Connie was just as much about the right, conservative media on the right as it was the left. Maybe it's not just as much, but also included that.
But she's not been shy about picking fights with people on the right too.
Right.
Or so, responding to people picking fights with her or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, overall her philosophy is we need to get back to doing reporting as it was supposed to be done. You know, heavy on the facts, not pushing a narrative, that kind of thing. And from my perspective, I actually find it a lot easy. It's easy to do. Maybe I've been doing it for so long. It's just ingrained in me. But, when I was writing for my student publication, I quickly found that I ran out of opinions that were well-developed enough to write something on that I was comfortable with publishing under my name. And you know, a lot of hot take slingers, whether they're just on social media or at a publication, you know, they're just slinging takes to sling takes. And yeah. I don't find that valuable. I want to get in the nitty-gritty. I want to do actual political reporting. And it's fun, you know? Like... interjecting my viewpoint on something would do nothing for the use of the piece and would not help the reader at all. So that's kind of how I approach it.
Do you think you have an advantage? And then when I say that, and I don't mean an unfair advantage, but do you think you have an advantage because you are affiliated with a center-right publication in a state, the political balance of Texas, in terms of, you know, source development, people being willing to talk to you? There was a point, you know, and I think this is, you know, I would talk to that. I talked to Jasper about this, Jasper Scherer at the Tribune about this last week. I mean, there was a point, I think there was a concerted effort where people, there were many people saying, I'm just not talking to the Tribune anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, is it fair to feel like you have a little bit of a structural advantage there?
Yeah.
In a Republican majority legislature?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's definitely fair to say. And I think it bears out in my sourcing. Part of it, I think, is I've said it already, basically, or, you know, indirectly, you know, I speak that language on the right. I come from that world. It was not my favorite thing to do, so which is why I left. But, a lot of it is, being able to talk on their level, understand what they're saying, even just the subtle things, you know, a reference here or there to something of conservative intellectual history, right? Like, that helps you build a relationship with these people, and they know that you're not out to get them. That's a big thing. Most reporters, I'd say, are generally not that way. But the perception can be that, especially when, you know, you give a quote to somebody and in a legacy outlet and they run with it and it's not as you as the person giving it intended it to be run. Right. So overall though, yes, I think that gives me a leg up. I think another thing that gives me a leg up in just the political sphere generally is I used to work in this world. And so like, especially the political side, where reporters who go to J school, they don't have the firsthand experience. It's tougher for them to learn the ins and outs, the subtleties of these political inside baseball things. And I think that's why I've been able to do this so well. It's because I have that background. I knew how to read a poll pretty well, not as well as you, Jim, but pretty well.
Questions, you know how to read a poll.
Yeah. it's a learning curve if you're not in this world already. So.
You know, I want to connect that a little bit with the earlier conversation we were having about social media. 6 years is a lifetime in at least the last 6 years in media terms. I mean, even since 2019 when you started, the structure of the media has really changed, right? Mm-hmm. In some of the ways we kind of touched on, I mean, the conversation we're having about elected officials using Twitter is an artifact of that in some ways, an artifact, cause effect there again. But, you know, I'm wondering if the proliferation of all these other kind of more distributed media, Substacks, podcast universe, social media, you know, has complicated this project of kind of corrective media coverage that the Texan kind of undertook to begin with. Because there's a pretty robust conservative media universe out there now that didn't exist 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering it's a little bit of an abstract question, but I think it probably affects how you do the job and certainly is affecting the business models
of
everything out
Absolutely.
There. I'm just wondering how you're experiencing that, what you think of that, if you have thoughts on that.
I was talking to Ross Ramsey a while back, former founder of the Texas Tribune, and he was telling me, he likes to follow reporters. I think that's kind of the way it's going. You know, you get a Substack and you get that person's thoughts. And I have a couple that I subscribe to the Dispatch. I like the Dispatch, but I get the Dispatch to read two guys. Right. I get a lot of comments from people, especially on the more insider side, that they subscribe to us because they want to read my stuff. Right. And that's not a knock on the rest of the publication, but that's kind of the way people are viewing this now. It's very...
It's the media manifestation of what we were talking about with politicians.
Exactly. Also on the streaming service stuff, the customizability, right? People want that. They want what they want when they want it, right? And, you know, when New York Times and Wall Street Journal are in a galaxy of their own, right? They're the two that are, you know, basically making a
they're about the only ones left, though, given what's going on with the Washington Post right now.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely affects things. As with anything, the scale you have to operate affects your ability to make money on anything. Yeah. And so, you know, we're pretty small, lean. You know, then you look at the Tribune, it's very large and they have a prolific output. Like they, the amount of stories they write and the length of those stories, the depth of those stories is massive. Now they're also a different model as a nonprofit. But when you scale up, it makes it a lot more difficult to break even on anything. I learned that in my last job, but, I think you're going to start seeing people get smaller and smaller, as much as, you know, I'd like for us to grow quite a bit, it's just easier to break even on that. And yeah. You just have to, in this world where people generally don't want to pay for news, they think, you know, they don't view it as a product. We at the Texan view news and what we write as a product for which you should pay. You get what you pay for, right? And, you know, that's, I specifically do not view it as this, you know, do it for the good of society thing. I don't think that's helpful. I don't think that scratches the consumer itch that you know, legacy media types generally think it does. It might get donations, but that's a different question, right? Different model. I don't know. Substack's definitely taken off, and
or you figure out, like, you know, like the Tribune and, like, you know, many. I mean, what's going on in the kind of the magazine world seems to me that, you know, you have to find other ways of generating revenue that's, you know, and then try to align it with your news product.
Right. Ultimately,
festivals,
though,
or, you know,
yes,
events.
Exactly.
Or, you know, Texas Monthly Options, you know, optioning projects.
And we had a big event previewing the session back in January, and it was a great success, especially financially. It was awesome. The kind of thing we'd only done once before, and we didn't maximize that first time, but we did this time. But overall, you have to provide a product that people want. And whether that's quality writing, quality analysis, good reporting, you know, look at what The Atlantic published in the Jeffrey Goldberg thing. Evan Smith told me the other day that was the biggest subscription day they've ever had on anything. Yeah. And, you know, the amount of traffic they got there because they had that massive story, you can't manufacture that with anything else. You just kind of, you have to provide a good product and then people will follow.
I mean, I was listening to, you know, one of the media podcasts and, you know, somebody was referencing the whole, you know, that whole breaking of that story and the way it happened is like, you know, a classic kind of old school journalism moment, right? Where, you know, not really through shoe leather this time, but, you know, guy gets
dumb luck, but
guy gets a big break.
Yeah.
And to be fair to Jeffrey Goldberg, I mean, you know, he's approached his job in a way that he's in a lot of people's phones. Now, at this point, that's an unintended consequence if somebody accidentally adds you to a signal.
Right.
But it's because he was in somebody's address book. But the point being that was a very old school kind of, you know, a scoop.
Right place, right time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a big story that people in Washington were all going to go.
Yep.
And it, you know, I'm not to downplay. I mean, a pretty interesting story with a lot of ramifications that I think the Trump administration has been pretty successful at dampening, you know, through velocity and tariffs. I mean,
yeah,
I'll see your threat to national security and raise you crashing the economy with tariffs.
I mean, with this, we see, as with anything, you know, scandal sells.
Right.
And this was a scandal. And it was real juicy, and, you know, great scoop on its part, and it bore out in the financial windfall they got from this.
Right, but also, you know, to where we were, you know, the story itself was old school. The way it propagated was very of the moment.
Yes,
right,
absolutely.
I think, you know, the advantage of being able to share that stuff via social media and how it got picked up and the way that they, you know, beat the drum on that story. I mean, I think I'm still getting emails from The Atlantic with yet another angle on
the got to milk it for all worth.
Yeah, right, which, you know, we all swim in the same ocean here. I want to ask you one last thing that's a little bit abrupt, and I could have done it earlier, but you did a event with my colleague Josh Blank over the weekend, which
that was fun. Weird.
Good. Yeah, no, and he had a very good time and he enjoyed it. It was, well, I'll we talk about it afterwards. It was actually a gig I was going to do, and then I couldn't. And
yeah, he told me you were a little salty about that.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad he picked up on that. But it was the bigger context that made me salty, which I was supposed to go to a music festival I love, and then I canceled, and I told them no because I was going to go to the festival. Then I realized I can't leave for this festival in the middle of like where work is and right now, and so I had handed it off and I declined it, and then anyway, the hook there is that per Josh, you mentioned something about. Something that's, I think, is old and now new again, at least if this is accurately reported to me, about Abbott running for president again.
Oh, yeah.
You think he's going to do it? I mean, what are you thinking about that? Because I think we've talked about it. I've been a longtime skeptic, and maybe I'm probably overinvested in my skepticism now, but I just can't quite see it. And I'm wondering, I'm just curious what you think.
I think the closest he was ever going to come, and I think he's definitely always thinking about it. I mean, he's had his eye on that for a long time. It's kind of the natural step up for a Texas governor.
Well, so we believe in Texas, but anyway, you know.
I mean, in terms of
that's
platform,
a sign that you are now become a true Texan, that you've adopted that position. I mean, if you're Texas governor, you might as well be president.
Right. Once we're a country, right?
Right.
I'm talking more on like a platform level. The mouthpiece, the megaphone Abbott has is almost second to none. You know, Trump is in a galaxy of his own, but Abbott is, you know, in that next echelon, right? And he's an ambitious guy. He's always been very committed and skillful at the nuts and bolts of running a campaign. Look at his fundraising. I mean, it's off the charts. But he's not going to jump at it when he has no shot, which is why I think he didn't jump in 24. If Trump was out of the picture and it was kind of a free for all, and you know he saw this as his chance to square up with Ron DeSantis, you know, I think he probably would have jumped in. Now, who knows how long he lasts, right? If he forgets one department that he wants to eliminate, there goes your
and you
candidacy.
Don't, you know, look, and you don't even have to forget anything. It's a, you know, presidential primary campaigns in a crowded field are pretty unforgiving.
I mean, the best example of that is Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin in 16 when he ran, and you know, he was the hottest thing since sliced bread in Republican politics for a while, and he flamed out so fast.
Yeah.
And when it was so quick.
Jeb Bush.
Right. So I think Abbott is definitely considering it, but odds are probably that he will not. And he definitely wants to be the longest serving governor in state history. He's got two more years of the next term to do that. And that does line up with 28. And so does he pull one of these campaigns to leverage into a cabinet position to kind of ride off into the sunset? Or does he actually go for it? And I think he'll have the opportunity to do that if he wants. And you know, the difference is, though, his biggest attribute is fundraising. And in Texas, there's no cap.
It's a different universe out there in federal races.
Yep, in federal races, you have a cap, and it's a lot more difficult. You can't go ask Javed Anwar for $1 million on a Tuesday, right?
And so, you can have big super PACs, but you still need to be able to raise your own money.
Absolutely, yep. Yeah. So I think it's possible. I wouldn't bet on it if we were allowed to bet in this state. But, there's my answer.
Okay. No, I was curious. And, you know, and the reason I'm interested in that, I mean, is probably overinvestment in the fact that, you know, I've staked my claim on this and nothing's changed my mind. It's hard. And I probably agree with you in that, I think he considers it. And I think if the opening presented itself and
well,
he thought
the probability. Timing. It's all about timing, right?
Right.
And, you know, how many guys, Ted Cruz and Chief among them, thought they were going to walk into this or really have a shot in 2016, and you have this bull in a china shop walk in, and it's Donald Trump, and
just starts swatting everybody.
Right.
It's like one of the
In hindsight, no one else was going to win that primary, not even if they did that unity ticket that they were trying to do for a bit.
Yeah,
that was Donald Trump's the moment he walked in.
Yeah, I kind of think about that primary like, I don't know if you, I'm betting you watch Game of Thrones.
Yes,
You know, like the Giants, every once in a while, there's one of those scenes where they grab a guy by the leg and just start whacking all the other guys.
Yeah.
That was kind of how Trump handled that whole that 2016 primary. All right. Well, that's, you know, I mean, one of the reasons I asked is because you know, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, so apologies to people that have heard this shtick before. But, you know, it was interesting to me in 23 and then also in 19 how many people in the guts of the process were really sure that Abbott was going to run. And it affected their strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it affected, you know, advocacy strategy. It affected the calculations.
Yep.
And people were just sure. I mean, I remember sitting at some, you know, rubber chicken event or something with a group of fairly seasoned lobby people. And I just kind of took the opportunity to ask them, kind of do a straw poll. Mm-hmm. And every person at this 10 top table was like, oh no, he's running.
Yeah.
And you know, you ignore that at your peril. And I think it really helped them. Right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the mechanisms here that I think is underappreciated, that it really is good for him to have people think that he's viable in that way, that it's one of those things that magnifies his influence in a kind of difficult to measure, but I think definite way. I mean, if you're sitting in a room full of people and everybody is sure this is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and, you know, I think generally when these guys reach this level of profile in national politics, you can assume they're running for president until they say they're not, because they are.
Or assume they're thinking about it at least, I guess.
Well, right. But, you know, they're all angling for it. They're strategizing. Like Greg Abbott, I know he personally believes in this school choice ESA stuff. He believes that it's the right thing to do. It's not just the money. The money helps. Like the Jeff Yass money, it made it a lot easier to go to the mat on this, right?
We're all adults here.
But I know he does actually believe in that. But it's also, in Republican politics, probably a pretty good thing to campaign for president on. If he gets it through, he can say, this is my marquee accomplishment in state politics.
In addition to Operation Lone Star.
Yes.
And
that
the busing.
Too. That too. So...
I mean, for a Republican primary, those are pretty good.
Absolutely.
Because that's, you know, you get, you know, I mean, it's overlapping, but, you know, there's one kind of for the far right there, and then there's one for the less far right in terms of vouchers, I think, you know.
I mean, the other thing about Abbott, though, is he's very calculated, and he's not an idiot. For example, he was very much thinking about jumping in 24, and as soon as he saw Trump running again, I'm not going to run to that buzzsaw. Why would I willingly do that? There's no reason. I'm not going to waste maybe my one shot I have at a presidential bid by going up against the former president.
Yeah.
Who is gold in Republican politics right now. So Ron DeSantis had a different view and he ran into the buzzsaw. Right. So Abbott was proved correct on that.
Yeah. And I think if we went and did a Google Trends search, DeSantis not really moving the needle much anymore. I mean, it was a pretty...
I mean, he almost took a spot in the cabinet, right? He was pretty close to that.
The cabinet thing is interesting, but we'll put a button because I have a hard time seeing feeling like Greg Abbott after being governor for this long, if he's not going to be president, wanting to be a cabinet member.
Well, and you know, I think this is my personal judgment on this. I don't have any inside information, but you know, I think he'd probably have to be one of the top cabinet positions. You know, whether it's attorney general, right? He is an attorney, was a judge. You know, Homeland Security Director.
Which would be a natural, I think, at this point.
Or Secretary of State.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very prolific at these, you know, foreign trips he does. Like, he's doing basically economic development with foreign nations for Texas. Yeah. He does that a lot. So I really only see those three as possibilities.
Well, that's not a very popular thing right at this moment.
Right. That's true. So, that is true.
Brad, this has been great. I appreciate you coming.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Thanks a lot. I hope we do it again soon. Brad Johnson of The Texan, you can read him at the Texan website, hear him opining in The Texan's pretty much weekly podcast, right?
Yep.
I don't know if you're a regular. Are you guys always do that round robin?
Yeah, we do that every week. And then we have an Texas Inside Politics one that my editor and I do once a month.
Okay, so watch for those. As always, thanks to our excellent audio production team here in the Dev Studio, the College of Liberal Arts. Generic term here at UT Austin. And as always, thanks to our audience for listening. Make sure you go to the Texas Politics Project website this week. We have an unusually prolific week of content. We've got pieces on Texas attitudes on tariffs, a revisiting of our deep dive into our February results on immigration policy, a couple of new graphics, and By the time you get to the website, hopefully or very shortly thereafter, this podcast will be there as well with supplemental data and links. So again, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another second reading podcast from the Texas Politics Project. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.